أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.
Warning, you are about to enter a war zone. In fact, two war zones. With the provocative title, Forever War, Dexter Filkins releases his memoirs of 10 years in the whirlwind of Afghanistan and Iraq. For the past 5 years, Filkins has been a freewheeling foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Don't expect any anti-war rhetoric or ideas of cause and culpability. As Filkins tells us in this speech, he is not covering Middle East policy from 1,000 miles up. He is dodging bullets and bombs on the ground, where an interview with a sheikh could just as easily turn out to be his own kidnapping. Now, after receiving numerous awards for his daring journalism, Dexter Filkin has been appointed to the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. We'll hear the speech in Vancouver, sadly missing the beautiful graphic slides, those photos found in the book. It was presented at the Capilano University Performing Arts Theatre, North Vancouver, Canada, on September 21, 2008. Then we'll toss in clips from the Q&A session, including an insider's tip on the whereabouts of one Osama bin Laden. Dexter Filkins.
Thank you. You know, I was listening to the introduction and I thought, God, 5 years in Iraq, like what lunatic would do that? And you were probably waiting for some guy that looked like a zombie to come staggering out here. In the 10 years that I've spent going into these terrible places, I've never actually stayed there the whole time. You know, we always sort of come in and come out and come in and come out, and it's really the only thing that can that keeps you sane. Thank you for coming. You know, as I was getting in the car to come here, I noticed that in America there's this big football game on. It's the Green Bay Packers versus the Dallas Cowboys. And I think if I had done this in America, there'd be like two people sitting in the front row. So I'm very grateful. Well, I thought what I would do is, you know, is tell you a little bit about my book, but more important, I'll tell you a little bit about the things I've seen and the places I've gone. And, you know, my book is kind of strange in the sense that, it's not strange, it's different. You know, I was a kind of accidental war correspondent. I was living in India in the late 1990s, and I was working for the Los Angeles Times back then. I work for the New York Times now. And my responsibility was mostly India, but I started going to Afghanistan, which was kind of part of my patch. And you know, back then, in the late 1990s, it was just a very, very strange and kind of wild place. And, you've probably seen all the shots on it on television, but it wasn't really connected to anything, so it didn't really matter. And it was a very, very weird time, particularly in retrospect. And I remember, one of the first chapter of the book, my book, opens at I went to a public execution and an amputation at the Kabul Sports Stadium on a Friday afternoon in September 1998. And it was just these kind of strange men called the Taliban, you know, reading Quranic verses as they, you know, lopped off and killed these people. And it was so strange at the time because, of course, it didn't really mean all that much, you know. And increasingly, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, but increasingly before 9/11, it got kind of weird. And I remember it just got stranger and stranger. Afghanistan did. I got arrested and expelled from the country. And, you know, I was seeing things, and I had Afghan friends by 2000, and they were saying things to me like, you know, the Arabs are here, and they're taking over, and they have these training camps outside of town. There's a guy named Osama bin Laden who's here. He's throwing a lot of money around. He's keeping the movement afloat. And I was sort of hearing these things, and it didn't really mean very much. And of course, you know, by 11 a.m. On September 11th, when I happened to be in New York, of course, it meant everything. And so then I started going back, and it's hard to believe that was 7 years ago. So I kind of did that, and then I've done the Iraq War, and so I have this I had this kind of giant grab bag of memories and scenes, and I've tried to kind of stitch them all together. My book is sort of unusual in the sense that I think most of the books about Iraq have been and Afghanistan have been sort of written from 10,000 feet up, you know, kind of how and why and what people in Washington did or, you know, in Ottawa. But I had seen so much and I'd seen it from the ground that I wanted and I thought I could sort of show people what it's actually like to be there. My book is actually, it's more visceral and more emotional than it is kind of intellectual in that sense. So I wanted to write about the desert and the heat and the blood and the sweat and, you know, what it's like to be shot at or to go to a car bombing or to sit across from a Sunni sheikh and wonder if he's lying to you or whether he's going to kidnap you, that kind of thing. Because it's all, you know, war is an extraordinary kind of human experience, and I wanted to try to sort of capture that in a very kind of visceral gut way. And so, but I also have a lot of pictures because I have a lot of photographers. I usually travel with a photographer, so I thought what I could do is I'll show you some pictures and I'll talk for a little bit, and then I'll just read a couple of bits from the book, and then you can ask me some questions, and, you know, if I start to go on for too long or something, just somebody let out a big yawn or run your finger across your throat or something, and I'll speed it up. You're very nice to indulge me. This is Afghanistan. You're probably, how many Canadian troops are in Afghanistan? Somebody call that out.
Too many.
Too many. Too many. Yes. Okay. Well, then you've seen the map. Well, let me just take you back, if I can. Afghanistan is an extraordinary country. I mean, just an amazing place. It's just an incredible place. You know, you get off the plane and you feel like you've sort of stepped into the fourth century in this beautiful country. It's very romantic. For even though, you know, you go into these towns and they haven't even seen the wheel yet, and the place is very brutal, but at the same time, it's just incredible, and the people are incredible. And I think the best way for me, when 9/11 happened, it wasn't that surprising, I think, by the time it happened. And the reason why it wasn't, and I can do this pretty quickly. Next picture, please. See, it's just amazing. This was actually a donkey parking lot. It really was. It was like, it was astonishing. It was sort of, you know, father time, you know, tending the donkeys. The way to understand, I think, Afghanistan and kind of what happened there and al-Qaeda and kind of everything that your own troops are involved in now is I've got a couple of photos I think that'll demonstrate this. When I got to Kabul in 1998, it was completely destroyed. I mean, just an absolutely imploded civilization. And I think that's the best way to understand it. It was so completely obliterated. By that time, it had been at war for 20 years. And the Taliban, and I'm going to read a little bit from my book in just a second. The Taliban were basically a bunch of country boys, you know, and they were really, really harsh and very, very righteous. And they were the meanest, toughest dudes. And they came in and they imposed order on the place, you know. And I remember, you know, people would say to you things like, you know, in 1992, there were 42 different militias that were fighting over Kabul, you know, and just to drive from one city to the other, your daughter could be raped, your son could be raped, you had to pay tolls and bribes. And the Talibs came in and kind of, they were the law and order boys, you know. And then what happened was over time, you know, as often happens with movements, popular movements, they become corrupt. And that's kind of what happened to the Taliban, you know, until when I got expelled in 2000. That's kind of where it was all heading, and you could really, really feel it. Now it's changed now, and we can, you know, I was just in, when we take questions, I was just in Pakistan a few weeks ago, right on the border, the Afghan border. I went into the tribal areas to try to figure all that stuff out, so we can talk a little bit about that. How about the next photo, please? This is downtown Kabul in 1998. I mean, that's a street called Jaidi Maiwand. And that's the main shopping street. And that's what it was like. I mean, there were sort of people living in the rubble, which is astonishing. So why don't I just read a little bit from the book. It's just a scene from Kabul in 1998. And it's just a couple of pages. In the late afternoons, the center of Kabul had an empty twilight feel, a quiet that promised nothing more than another day like itself. There were hardly any cars then, just some women floating silently in their head-to-toe burqas. Old meat hung in the stalls, buildings listed in the ruins. One of those afternoons, a thin little shoeshine boy walked up to me. He was smiling and running his finger across his throat. "Mother is no more," he said, finger across his neck. "Father is finished." His name was Nasir, and he repeated the phrase in German and French, smiling as he did. "Mutter ist nicht mehr, Vater ist fertig." He dragged his finger across his throat again. "Rockets," he said. "Rocketen." His pale green eyes were rimmed in black. He did not ask for money. He wanted to clean my boots. Then he was gone, scampering down the muddy street with his tiny wooden box. Kabul was full of orphans like Nasir, woebegone children who peddled little labors and fantastic tales of grief. You'd see them in packs of 50 and sometimes even 100, skittering in mismatched shoes and muddy faces. They'd thunder up to you like a herd of wild horses. You could hear the padding of so many tiny feet. Sometimes I'd wonder where all the parents had gone, why they let their children run around like that. And then I'd catch myself. The orphans would get out of control sometimes, especially when they saw a foreigner, grabbing and shoving one another until they were scattered by one of the men with whips. They'd come out of nowhere, the whip wielders, like they'd been waiting off stage. The kids would squeal and scatter, then circle back again, grinning. If I raised a hand, they'd flinch like strays. If a war went on long enough, the men always died, and someone had to take their place. Once I found seven boy soldiers fighting for the Northern Alliance on a hilltop in a place called Bangui. The Taliban positions were just in view, a minefield in between. The boys were wolf-like, monosyllabic, with no attention spans, eyes always darting, laughing the whole time, dark fuzz instead of beards. They wore oddly matched apparel like high-top tennis shoes and hammer and sickle belts, embroidered hodge caps, and Russian rifles. I tried to corner one of the boys on the hill. His face was half wrapped in a checkered scarf that covered his mouth. His name was Abdul Waqdud. All I could see were his eyes. I kept asking him how old he was, and he kept looking over at his brother. His father had been killed a year before, he said, but they fed him here, and with the money, he could take care of his whole family, $30 a month. "My mother is not weeping," Abdul said. I could see how bored he was, and his friends definitely noticed, because one of them started firing his Kalashnikov over our heads. That really got them going, laughing hilariously and falling over each other. Two of them started wrestling. My photographer and I calmed them down and asked them to pose in a picture with us, and they lined up and grew very grave. After that, they stood behind us in a semicircle and raised their guns, not like they were aiming at anything, but more like they were saluting. Then a couple of men appeared on the hilltop, bearing a kettle of rice, and the boys descended on it. The Taliban came down the road a few months later. I've got the boy's picture on a bookcase in my apartment. This is Ahmed Shah Massoud, who is the last holdout rebel commander in northern Afghanistan. You can see he's a very dynamic-looking guy, very good-looking. He looks like sort of an Italian painter, you know, and he was actually fluent in French, really, really extraordinary guy. I saw him, you know, he was killed 2 days before 9/11 by al-Qaeda, because as they sort of understood that the Americans would come to him and try to, you know, help him out at last. Next photo. This is his sort of ragtag broken down army in northern Afghanistan. This is 1999. That's Massoud here on the left. I got arrested and expelled by the Taliban. I joined the New York Times in 2000, and then on 2001 in New York, I was in September 11th. I happened to be in New York. I went down to Ground Zero for about a week, and then as it became clear that the United States was going to go to war in Afghanistan, I flew back to Afghanistan. So in just a second, I'm going to read you something from that time. And next photo, there's Abdul Waqdud again. That time was so strange. It's so different from now because, you know, the war then was... we were like on the winning team, you know, and I just hooked up with these Northern Alliance guys and I drove across northern Afghanistan. The Taliban collapsed. We'd go into these villages and people would be cheering and, you know, the women would be throwing their burqas off and the men would be digging up these TVs that they'd buried, you know, 3 years before. And it was incredible and the music would be playing and it was just an amazing, God, it was an amazing, you know, they'd be shaving their beards off. And it was just an amazing time to be alive, you know, and it was such an extraordinary thing to see. For me, seeing Iraq 18 months later, driving into Iraq and seeing not the same thing at all. And of course, now here we are in year seven, you know, in the Afghan war, as you well know. I just saw this TV report today saying these, you know, talking about these two Canadian units that were changing hands. But it was so different then. You know, it just seemed, I think it's fair to say that this war was sort of forgotten about, certainly by the Americans, by the American administration. And, you know, it kind of, it's a shame because it was the good war, it was the war that everybody supported. Next photo. This is just a, you see how all the Afghans, they're so good looking, the Afghans. This is just a Northern Alliance commander who I got to know, named Atikula Berialai. He's still around. So back then, you know, there weren't really many Americans on the ground. There were basically, they were in the air. There were the B-52s, and there were the helicopters. There were some special forces guys around, but there basically weren't any troops on the ground. And the whole thing just, you know, collapsed, and the Northern Alliance kind of took over stuff. How about the next one? And so I'm just going to read you, about the B-52s from the book. How about just a couple more photos, because I think we're going to get in. Yeah, this is the first day. I don't know how many of you have had the good fortune to see a 2,000-pound bomb explode, but it's not like the movies, you know? It's like an earthquake, basically. And I remember James Hill and I, the photographer who took most of these photos, we had rented this mud hut in a town called Hoja Bawadin. And it was the nicest mud hut in the whole town because it was the only mud hut that had windows. And we actually had glass windows. And I remember one morning we woke up, you know, October 12th or something, and the windows were just rattling and rattling. It was like an earthquake, you know. And it wasn't just bang. It was like the ground shook for like 5 minutes, you know, and that's what this was. And we drove as fast as we could to get to the front. And these are like the bomb, you know, the contrails of the jets. So here, I'm just going to read you a little bit from that time. On a clear day, you could see the B-52s overhead, their contrails marking the sky in long white streaks. They seemed to float up there, so high above. Sometimes, given their altitude, they took half an hour to traverse the whole horizon. The exhaust plumes hung in the air long after the planes had moved on. And so on some afternoons, the whole sky would be looped and crisscrossed, white against the blue, like a work of abstract art. It wasn't just the bombs that were so unnerving. It was the lumbering, disassociative way they let them go. One of the bombers would make an appearance, usually at 30,000 feet, a tiny gray V in the sky, all the way from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, 3,000 miles away, gliding like a crane. Then, without warning, the sharp, titanic bursts, the clouds tumbling upwards, the ground moaning as if something crucial in the world had broken off and fallen away. And then you'd look up, and there the plane would be, arcing, plodding, moving across the great blue sky. Sometimes at night, working late in the mud brick hut, I'd hear the faint whoop, 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 and rush outside, and if I was lucky, I'd see a blackened silhouette against the star-flecked night. A helicopter without lights, here then gone. The Americans were here, the Afghan said, but I didn't see any of them until much later. On the morning the bombing started, the windows in my house clinked and rattled for minutes on end, like a tea service in an earthquake. I drove as fast as I could, as far as I could, forded the Kokcha River on a horse, ran crouching through the muddy Northern Alliance trenches, reached the most forward post, and peeked my head up over the top. The Taliban positions were just in view, only 300 yards away. A rolling green field lay between. Up and down the Taliban trench line, the blasts from the bombs had left gigantic circles of blackened grass, like the footprints of some huge beast, 50 feet wide. Blackened hoof after blackened hoof, concentric and overlapping. The bombs had hit the trenches precisely, gone directly inside. And there, across the field, rose the turban head of a Taliban soldier, looking to his right and then to his left, amazed, perhaps, that he was alive. I felt sorry for those Taliban fighters. I really did, just sitting in their trenches, trapped, uncomprehending, waiting to be bombed. I was right about that, right about what they'd felt. I saw the Taliban prisoners afterwards, dirty and frightened, and all they talked about were the bombs. For the Taliban, the waiting was the worst. A B-52 would appear in the sky, drop a bomb or two, and then begin his great U-turn toward his home on Diego Garcia. The B-52s took forever to make that turn, arcing slowly and grandly, turning like an aircraft carrier. And just when I thought the B-52s were finally headed south, headed home, it would keep turning, keep circling back, and then I knew that it was coming back for another run. Sometimes it would take half an hour, and then I'd imagine the Taliban guys in their trenches, fiddling with their prayer beads, looking up, waiting. In the end, they just ran up near the Tajik border where I was. The Americans bombed every day for 3 weeks, and when the Northern Alliance commanders fired a few tank rounds and sent their men out of their own trenches to go and fight, the Taliban held on for a couple of days, even counterattacked, and then they finally just gave up and ran. I never saw it, never saw the Talibs running, but I walked through their empty trenches later on, stepped on the charred grass, walked into the craters, picked up the odd rifle. It wasn't hard to imagine what the Talibs were feeling when they finally climbed out of the trenches and ran. Glorious, horrifying release. The whole war was about the B-52s, at least in the beginning. A few weeks later, at the siege of Kunduz, the last of the Taliban units started surrendering, driving out of their own front lines, and all their trucks were smeared with mud. Doors, hoods, even windows covered with mud to hide them from the B-52s. Driving across northern Afghanistan soon after, I saw the wreckage everywhere, the Hiluxes and the old Soviet Kamaz trucks, the tanks and the Toyotas, overturned inside the craters, shoes and shreds of clothing splayed in every direction. Boom. Okay, well, you know, that was 7 years ago. It was a long time ago. How about the next picture, please? This was this extraordinary scene. The Northern Alliance marching into Kunduz, thinking that the Taliban were surrendering. The next picture, please. And here they are again, marching in. You know, the Taliban has surrendered. The Taliban has surrendered. Let's see the next one. It was a double cross, and it completely went wrong. It was just an incredible time. Let's go a little longer. And then we'll get to the really pleasant topic of Iraq. Let's get to the next one. I was just literally driving. These are prisoners, Taliban prisoners. Astonishing. I was driving across. Can you actually back up? I don't know if you can see how flat it is. There's these mountains here, but the steppe in northern Afghanistan is like the top of a pool table. It's so flat. I mean, you can see there isn't a tree for 150 miles. And I was just driving across going to Mazar-e-Sharif, and I came across these trucks just sitting here in the middle of nowhere. And they didn't know where to go, and they had taken all these prisoners. And of course, the Afghans don't take prisoners, and I think they had sort of been asked to do so for the Americans. But I think all these guys were killed in the end. But let's go to the next one. It was just incredible. You can see, obviously, how concerned they were about the prisoners' welfare. These guys have been rounded up. Let's go to the next one. They're just extraordinary. You can see, I was standing here. They let me walk right up to the truck. And I could hear the word water. They weren't giving them any water. I could hear the word water in about six languages. You know, Arabic, Pashto, Urdu. It's just incredible. I mean, you can see, if you just sort of look at some of these faces, I mean, that guy's an Arab for sure. Have the next photo? Yeah. I mean, look at the guy above with the black turban. I mean, you know, where on earth is he from? How about the next one? We just got a couple of these left. This is just a battle scene. You can see they're kind of picking over the bodies, you know, checking for jewelry and money. But this is actually a Saudi kid from who I found. He'd been taken prisoner. I think they shot him afterwards. But actually, that's yours truly on the road. That's actually the road to. And I have to tell you, most roads in Afghanistan aren't this good. This is just this little stretch of highway that is on the way to Kandahar. I think this is right where the Canadians are right now, because this is kind of south of Herat before you get to Kandahar. I'm going to have to blow through Iraq here. I hope I'm not. How am I doing on time? I'm just going to show you a few pictures, and then I'll read you a couple. I went into Iraq on the first day of the war. I drove in a rented Ford Yukon, which is like the dumbest thing I ever did. I wasn't embedded. I drove that rented Ford Yukon all the way to Baghdad. Those were the happy days. They lasted about about a week. In fact, I should just hold the photo here. This is the central bank being looted. I'll tell you one quick story. I'm going to read something and then we'll go. But I drove my rented Ford Yukon into Baghdad on April 9th, the day the regime fell. And it was such an extraordinary moment because it was essentially, you know, the day when it all came apart. And, you know, the American army, I mean, it sort of came into Baghdad that day, the conquering army. You know, it took 19 days. It had gone 300 miles all the way up driving into Baghdad, you know, driving towards Baghdad. I could see the Iraqi army uniforms in little piles. Guys were just taking off their uniforms, you know. And I remember I slept in a palm grove that night, and April 8th. And I remember I was shadowing some Marines who were there, and I asked them what's going to happen tomorrow. And they said, well, there might be a fight, there might not be. So, you know, by 7 a.m., as I drove into Baghdad, it was clear there was not going to be any fight at all. By 10 a.m., the looting had started. By noon, the ministries were on fire. You know, and I just remember the feeling. I felt like, not to use a sports metaphor, but I felt like I was on a football team that was ahead 40-0, and there was 2 minutes left in the game, and we were going to lose. You know, it was just an extraordinary. I just felt like every minute that this keeps going on, it's going to be like another year. And sure enough, you could just really feel it all come apart that day. How about the next photo? We'll stop it here. This is an extraordinary photo. I mean, it just kind of sums it all up, doesn't it? I mean, this is some 19-year-old, probably from Kansas. He barely knows what country he's in. And, you know, I don't have to say anything about him. Why don't I just keep it there, and I'll just read you a little bit from Iraq. As Fiona said, I ran in Baghdad. I always ran, and it was just a very strange thing. And I ran all the way until late 2006. And, you know, I think I had some sort of death wish at the time, but... anyway, in the beginning, it wasn't so bad. So this is kind of what I'm going to read you here is sort of July or August of 2003, long time ago. I pulled on my running shoes and stepped into the street. It was a Thursday in July, twilight and well over 100 degrees. I was feeling a little reckless. If this ended badly, the only thing anyone would remember was how stupid I was. We'd set up the New York Times office on Abu Nawas Street, and there we lived and worked. It was an Ottoman-style house with a gated yard and a veranda on the second floor that looked out on a boulevard that tracked the eastern bank of the Tigris River. In those first days, we didn't fortify the place. No razor wire or blast walls. No watchtowers or machine guns mounted on the roof. Cars motored past our front yard on their way to the Jumeirah Bridge, a couple of miles up the road. In the beginning, Baghdad wasn't that threatening. The other houses around us were either abandoned or rented by foreigners. The French embassy and the BBC were around the corner. And the Iraqis in the neighborhood were unusually friendly, waving whenever we passed. Running at night seemed reckless, but given the otherworldly heat, running during the day was impossible. So I set off. The reaction of my neighbors was immediate. Men looked up and waved. They held up bottles of water as I ran by. "Good, good," one man said in English. "America, good." Abu Nawas was lined with fish restaurants that overlooked the Tigris. I'm sorry, that overlooked the Tigris. As I passed, men held up chunks of masgouf, their beloved bony fish, and asked me to join them. Children stopped their soccer games and ran after me. Even the stray dogs gave pursuit. I felt like I was living the scene in Rocky when the character played by Sylvester Stallone goes for a training run in its Philadelphia neighborhood, and all the children clamor after him. I started running that same route every evening after that, usually well into twilight, but early enough that the streets were still filled with people. My reaction was always the same, cheering crowds, squealing children, and happy stray dogs. In an odd but real way, my 5-mile runs up Abu Nawas Street made me wonder what the war in Iraq was about. All day long, reporting in the country, I encountered hostility and chaos, which was intense and growing and real. And yet at night, when I hit the streets in the fall of 2003, I could not find a trace of it. It was as if the city, in the heat of the afternoon, had exhausted itself, only to lighten with the setting sun.
These are the memoirs from Afghanistan and Iraq by the New York Times foreign correspondent, Dexter Filkin. More gritty scenes to come after this brief break. خشيني We are back with a haunting speech by Dexter Filkins, award-winning foreign correspondent for The New York Times. This speech was recorded in Vancouver on September 21, 2008, by Alex Smith. Having developed his experience in Afghanistan since 1998, Filkins now continues describing his 5 years reporting from the war zones of Iraq.
One day early on, a young Iraqi boy ran up alongside me. He'd been kicking a ball along Abu Nawas, and as I came running, he left his friends and started running next to me in his bare feet. The locals sometimes did that, but usually they stopped after 50 yards. The Iraqi boy, who was perhaps 9 years old, kept running the 2.5 miles to the Jumeirah Bridge. As I turned to run back on the trail along the Tigris, he dropped off to wave goodbye. A few days later, at twilight, the same boy appeared again, picking up the trail along the Tigris. His name, he said, was Hassan. We ran together for a while, me in my running shoes, he in his bare feet. Hassan motioned across the Tigris River toward the sprawling compound that once housed Saddam Hussein's Republican Palace and which was now the headquarters of the American occupation, the Green Zone. Saddam House, he said. We ran together some more, and Hassan motioned again across the river. Now, Bush House. One night, without warning, a wall of razor wire went up across Abu Nawas Street. Somebody somewhere had decided that the Sheraton Hotel, which sat just 100 yards away, was too easy a target for the car bombers who had just begun striking the city. A barricade now stood between me and the rest of the neighborhood. All traffic ceased. A few days later, sensing the disruption they had caused, the Americans made an opening in the razor wire so pedestrians could walk through. I resumed my running, but I never saw Hassan again. One afternoon later in the summer, another Iraqi youngster pulled alongside me as I made my way down the street. She, like Hassan, was about 9 years old. Her name was Fatima, she said, huffing next to me and looking up at me with enormous brown eyes. She wore sandals, and she was very dirty. She kept up the pace. Fatima and I ran for a couple of miles, her sandals making a scraping sound on the pavement. After a time, she indicated that she needed a rest. We stopped at one of the open-air fish restaurants. Everyone seemed to know Fatima. She seemed to know them. A man walked out onto the sidewalk, put a hand on Fatima's shoulder, and ran a finger across his neck. "Mother, father, finished," the man said. He pointed up to the sky, as if to suggest that they had been killed by bombs. "Fatima live here," the man said, gesturing with his hand to encompass the restaurant and its environs. Then a second man walked up, twisted Fatima around, and gave her a long and ugly kiss on her lips. He laughed and walked away. Fatima looked at me with very sad eyes, and I suggested that it was time to go. We ran some more, and then, after a time, Fatima stopped. She looked up at me one last time. "Bye-bye tomorrow, okay?" Fatima said, and she turned and walked up the street. I never saw her again. Okay, so why don't we just do a couple more pictures? Well, I don't need to explain a lot here. You know, just very briefly, I'll explain. I think I can explain the whole war with this photo. The Americans, and you could see this, you know, I could, back in the old days, in 2003, 2004, I could go anywhere I wanted, and as a reporter. I mean, I think now we're up to 150 reporters have been killed in Iraq. It's totally different now, but... we could go anywhere, and you could go into these villages, the Sunni villages outside of Baghdad, and the Americans, you know, the insurgency had started, it was very small, and the Americans had this kind of very, very heavy-handed approach, and they would go into villages like this, and they would sort of grab all the men, basically, everybody between the ages of 17 and 35. And, you know, they didn't defeat the insurgency, they grew it, and basically you can kind of see that. You can kind of see that right there with this picture. How about the next one? This is a car bombing. No talk about Iraq would be complete without these. This was a suicide bombing in late 2003. How about the next photo? These are kind of grim. You can see how young these guys are, you know. It was a suicide bombing attack on the Red Cross in late 2003, and it was sort of came right after the attack on the UN. Again, it was so long ago. And the next day, within a month, every NGO and aid organization that had been in Iraq was gone. And, you know, it was, the insurgents knew exactly what they were doing. How about the next one? You can see, you know, you don't need to show a lot of photos of these, but it's kind of, you know, in America, I don't know what you see in Canada, but it's very frustrating, because in America, you sort of see a headline on television or in a newspaper, and it says, you know, 50 killed in car bomb attack, blah, 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 right? And you go on to the next story. It is unbelievable to be at one of these. It is just basically the end of the world. You know, I remember this was about two blocks from the New York Times house. It was about 8:30 in the morning. The walls of our house shook like it was a toy. And I remember I ran out the door, and as I was running towards, there's a school right next to the ICRC, and I remember the Iraqi schoolgirls, it was a girls' school, and they were all dressed in their uniforms, just kind of wide-eyed and screaming, kind of running out. And it's just so catastrophic. And, you know, there have been hundreds and hundreds of these. And if you could just take a city like Vancouver and imagine, I mean, Baghdad is bigger than Vancouver, but just imagine 900 suicide bombings, as there have been in Baghdad since 2003. 2,000 car bombs. I mean, what it does to a city and what it does to people's minds, you know, it's just, it's insane. How about the next photo? This is just, I'll just walk you through these photos. This is an open-air mosque in downtown Baghdad. If you can look over way on the left, you can see a poster of Muqtada al-Sadr, who's the Shiite, the kind of the young Shiite cleric. And this is just an amazing thing to see because it's all men. It's about 25,000 of them on any Friday afternoon. And if you just wanted to kind of get a sense of his power, they'd all be chanting Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. Just incredible, you know? How about the next photo? This is just a scene. I'm with some Marines and we're getting bombarded. How about that? This is me. You can see this is a portable latrine over on the left. Let's go to the next one. This is sort of, I've got a bunch of shots. These were all taken by Ashley Gilbertson, who's a photographer. And I'm sure the same, if I went to Afghanistan with Canadian soldiers, I could get the same shots, or Ashley could. He's very, very talented. It's just a very strange thing. I mean, I'm 47. I'm probably too old to be out there, but they're so young, these soldiers. You know, they're just kids. They're children. And you can sort of see that here. This was in the middle of a battle, the Battle of Fallujah in November 2004. And I was with a unit of guys, or 150 of them. Why don't we go to the next? I was with 150 guys, Bravo Company, 1-8 Marines. At the end of 8 days, we had 25% of our guys were killed or wounded. It was just intense, you know. This is just these guys during a break. He was killed. That's DeMarcus Ware from Virginia. He was Nathan Anderson here on the right. He was killed. Why don't you just keep it there? Why don't I do this? I'll just read one little bit more, and then I got a couple more photos, and then you can, like, take some questions or something. And I should say, I just came back from Iraq, 8 days ago. I was there, and I was in Pakistan, so it's changed a lot. I'll just read a little bit. Now, I should say, this has got some profanity in it, the following, and it's when you hang out with these 19-year-olds, it's like their own language, you know? It's like every other word is like profanity. And it's just kind of the way it is, and you can't really capture sort of what it's about unless you quote them word for word, which I've done here. Now, this, what I'm going to read you is 2 years ago. It's in Ramadi, which is out in Anbar province, which is the kind of the cradle of the Sunni insurgency. And it was astonishing. Downtown Ramadi is the capital of Anbar province, completely destroyed, completely destroyed. There was one building that still stood in downtown Ramadi. It was called the government center, and that's, the Marines were holding it at all cost. We came under attack every day, and I just spent a couple weeks with them, and it was just it was like being in a parallel universe, which I've tried to capture here. So again, there is a little bit of profanity, but. In the mornings, you could stand on the rooftop of the government center in downtown Ramadi and watch the Iraqis trickle into the streets far away. The cityscape was obliterated for a mile in each direction. Total ruin, like Grozny or Dresden. The Marines had given names to the blown-up buildings, Swiss cheese, battleship gray. The human activity unfolded beyond that, at the outer edges of the destruction. From the top of the government center, the Iraqis seemed like tiny figures in a greater landscape, trudging to some end they did not know. By noon, the landscape would be empty again. It was a joke among the Marines posted there, the government center, since there wasn't much of either. The center of the city was obliterated, and the government had ceased to exist. There was a governor, a half-crazed man named Mamoun Sami Rashid, but most everyone else in the government was dead or in hiding. A few months before, Rashid's secretary had been beheaded. Rashid lived a weird, cloistered life, driving with the Marines, flying with the Marines, surrounded by the Marines in the rubble of his hometown. There were two worlds at the government center, the rooftop and the interior. Unless you were going out to fight, fully loaded, the outside was off limits. The moment you stepped out of the building, you had to run. You had to run everywhere, even to your Humvee. No standing. It was the snipers. The toilets were broken, naturally, since there was no water, but you couldn't go outside for that either. There were no portalettes because the snipers would have gotten them too. You had to do your business indoors into a small green sack called a wag bag, a name for the flammable chemicals it carried in its lining. When you were done, you'd tie up the wag bag and toss it into a regular trash bag, and one of the grunts would take it out at night and set it on fire. The snipers were good. In Iraq, the insurgents might have been raggedy-ass guys who scored by rigging blasting caps to rusty artillery shells, but a number of them were former soldiers, and some of them were snipers. They carried Russian Dragunov rifles with huge scopes and long barrels. They aimed for the neck, in the soft spot between your helmet and flak jacket. The Marines, all from Kilo Company, lived inside, about 75 at a time. The place reeked, of course, of stale urine and old clothes and so many bodies pressed too close together. There weren't any showers. You showered after you came out. The urinals didn't really work, but they used them anyway. Sometimes the piss would drain through the pipe, and sometimes it would leak out on the floor and go stale. The guys slept 8 to a room, stacked together like kids in a dormitory. The rooms had windows, but most of them had been shot out and boarded up. The tours at the government center lasted 2 weeks, long enough to make anyone crazy. One Marine, David, lived by himself in a tiny crawl space on the second floor, opposite the stairwell that took you up to the roof. He was from Tampa. His job was to keep the rest of the Marines supplied with water and food, which wasn't much of a job, a kind of make-work thing. He was a sort of Boo Radley character, friendly, but a little slower than the others. Most of the time, David stayed inside the cubbyhole, playing violent video games. Whenever I walked past his room, I could hear the explosions. "I've never been on the roof," David said, gesturing towards the sunlight in the stairwell. "Ain't never going up there." And nobody was forcing him to. The Marines were young, and they made the most of their circumstances. They kept a weight room on the first floor, dark and sandy, and they played Metallica and pumped iron till they fell asleep, banging music and banging weights. They slept more than you would think. Generators kept the AC going, and the boarded-up windows made the rooms dark, and most of the guys would sleep through the gun battles on the roof. The heat outside was astounding, but the guys still went out most days, loaded with gear and guns, into the night, into the rubble, looking to waste people. Sometimes when they ran, they tossed canisters that threw up green smoke. I never heard them talk about hearts and minds. "We go out and kill these people," Captain Andrew Delgadio said. He was in charge. There was a primal simplicity to being in Ramadi that made it refreshing, even in the stink of it. There were no politics to complicate things, like there were back in Baghdad. Here, people were fighting to the death. I asked Delgadio how his men were doing. "Let's see," he said. "Lance Corporal Tussey, shot in the thigh. Lance Corporal Zimmerman, shot in the leg. Lance Corporal Sardinus, shrapnel, hit in the face. Corporal Wilson, shrapnel in the throat." "That's all I can think of right now," the captain said. Delgaudio was 30, an Italian from Parkchester in the Bronx. Sitting there glowering in his T-shirt, he reminded me of one of those tough guys from a 1950s movie, Brando without the charm. I guess he had a right to be angry, trapped in this desert shithole and charged with killing people. I asked Delgaudio to take me out on one of the night patrols, and he told me to forget it. "You'd probably step on something and blow us all the fuck up." So, I think we have a couple more pictures, and then I can take some questions. This is really a nice photo. I was with this unit of guys, Bravo Company, the 1-8. We were in Fallujah. As I said, 25% of the unit was killed or wounded in 8 days. It was very intense. I got to know the guys pretty well. They had a memorial service at their Marine base in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And they invited me to go, so I went. And it was really something. I thought, you know, America, I honestly don't know. I don't know Canada well enough to know if this is similar. But in America, a typical grunt, you know, he's not from Manhattan. He's not from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's not from Santa Monica. You know, he's from Nowhereville, North Dakota, you know, or Keeseltown, Virginia, or Starkville, Mississippi. And, you know, as a result, the war doesn't really resonate in a way that you would think. It just doesn't, you know. And so Iraq and Afghanistan, for most people in the United States, is kind of an abstraction. It really is. And I think it's why people argue so vehemently about it, because there's nothing at stake. And then, so I flew to this, it took me forever, I flew to this little town in North Carolina called Jacksonville. And I was sort of thinking there'd be a parade and a big band and, you know, all the local reporters would be there. And I got there, and it was in a high school gymnasium, this memorial service. You can't see here, but most of the bleachers weren't pulled out. Almost nobody came. There weren't any reporters. There was no parade. There was nothing, you know, just these guys. And I think one of their girlfriends. But it was a very sad thing to see. It really was. It just kind of, you know, and there on the gym floor was a V with 16 graves in it, you know, with the helmets and the boots and the helmets, and kind of, you know, nobody was paying attention. I think I can take your questions now if you want to do that.
Dexter Filkins, war correspondent for the New York Times, has finished his speech, kicking off his new book, Forever War, published by Knopf. But Filkins was just beginning to warm up as he left the podium, joining Capilano University host Fiona Black for written questions from the audience. We have time to run a couple of clips, but you can download the whole Dexter Filkins speech plus the 32-minute Q&A session as a free MP3 from ecoshock.org. Click on Military in our Audio On Demand menu at ecoshock.org. Let's go back to the Middle East conflicts.
Here's what... First one, how different would all this have been if the U.S. used a conscripted force?
Wow, that's a really good question. Yeah. Man, who asked that question? That's a really good question. Boy, I personally, I think if there was a draft, it would be over tomorrow. Yeah. Really? I mean, can you... It's just an astonishing thing. I mean, after the Battle of Fallujah that I talked about, I flew from Iraq to Manhattan. And I was sitting in a bar like 3 days later drinking a martini that I paid like $14 for, you know? And you know, people say, hey, you were in Iraq. Wow, what was it like? You know? And then before I can get a sentence out, they say, wow, did you see the game last night? I mean, it's just not the same.
Okay. There's a lot of talk about the success of the surge in Iraq. What's your take? Is there any success in this war?
Yeah. I just came from Iraq. It's the conditions are... remarkably better. It's astonishing, actually. You know, I left there in 2006 when it was utterly nightmarish in every way. It was like a science fiction movie. It was so awful. You know, 40, 50 people a day being kidnapped. It was unbelievable. And I went back, and I'll just give you a quick example. I mean, I think the violence is down 90%. You know, whether this can be sustained past the American presence is... You know, that's completely another question. But just to answer your question, there's the park outside of our house where I used to run. By 2006, that was strung with barbed wire. There was a militia checkpoint at one end. There was an Iraqi army checkpoint at the other. It was completely vacant, completely dead. No one went into the park during daytime, certainly not at nighttime. You know, a week ago, there were 2,000 people in that park, you know, walking around at dusk, at night. Parents or children, women walking alone, which is just mind-boggling, women in jeans, you know, stuff I had never seen. So it's definitely brought the violence down, you know, but is it going to work without the Americans? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a really tricky, you know, the arrangements that are keeping the peace are very, very fragile and they're very tentative.
A question about women and children in Afghanistan. Are they better off now? Should Canadian forces stay?
Should Canadian forces stay? Boy, I don't know. Let me think about that for a second. I still think Afghanistan is sort of the good war. I mean, I know too many Afghans to say take pack up and leave. And I think the war certainly, you know, was a noble war in the beginning. It's very, very hard to be optimistic about it just because it looks like to me, and I'm not an expert in Afghanistan, I haven't spent a lot of time there in the last several years, but it looks to me like it was shortchanged for so long, you know, because Iraq was the focus, that it kind of, you know, now it's slipping and now it's gone very, very bad, you know, and now there's more American casualties in Afghanistan than there are in Iraq, you know. And so I think it's going to be a successful outcome. It's going to be many, many years away, you know, which is, of course, what you're going to have to decide.
Just a couple more on Afghanistan. Do the Afghans believe that Osama bin Laden is alive?
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with somebody about that in Pakistan a few weeks ago. Extraordinary conversation. Most of the American intelligence people believe he's in Pakistan, on the Pakistani side of the border, in this area called the federally administered tribal areas. It's this kind of it's a very, very kind of remote place. There's no government there to speak of. It was kind of set up by the British because they couldn't conquer it. And basically it's a sanctuary for anybody, you know, for whether it's the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever. And I think it's kind of, if, you know, if we had somebody here from Washington right now, they'd say, or Ottawa, they'd say, that's kind of problem number one. Like, what do we do with the tribal areas? It's a sanctuary. We can't, all they have to do is run across the border again. They can plan attacks. They can do whatever they need to do. I had this unbelievable conversation with the head of a very, very large tribe in South Waziristan. There's only two tribes in Waziristan, in South Waziristan. And South Waziristan is the place where, if you ask, say, most intelligence people or most people, a lot of people in Pakistan, they believe that in South Waziristan, in this particular place, is where Osama is. He may not be, but I asked this tribal leader. And it took me weeks to persuade this guy to talk, and I had to bring him out of the tribal areas. He was terrified, and I kind of, you know, we had to meet in secret. It was just horrendous. But he said to me at one point, there are Arabs in South Waziristan, you know? And I said, how do you know? And he said, well, you can hear them speaking Arabic in the bazaars. And then he said, but the important Arabs are in the mountains. And I said, important Arabs? And I said, how do you know they're important? And he said, they have Arabian horses. We don't have horses like that in South Waziristan. He said, those horses eat better than the common people do. I know this because our people take food up to them. They've seen the horses. They've seen the Arabs. I said, Osama? You know, what important Arabs? He said, I don't know. You know, but they have a lot of money. They're important.
Someone's referring to your article in today's New York Times.
Yes. Wondered if anybody had seen that.
Yeah, suggests civil war was expected in Iraq. Can this peace be maintained? How does Iran figure into the equation?
Yeah, it's like too many questions. But, which one do I pick? How does Iran figure? I don't, God. How does Iran figure? It's kind of the great unknowable, you know? It really is. You know, the Americans say, well, they're supporting the Shiite militias, et cetera, et cetera. They are, undoubtedly. I mean, they're very, very savvy, and they're extremely sophisticated in what they do, and they clearly, their goal in Iraq, I mean, it's not remarkable even to say, they want to have a weak government, right? They want to have a government which isn't strong and one that they can dominate and manipulate. Again, that's not terribly a surprising thing to say, but the manifestations of Iran in that country are extremely difficult to find. You can talk to people who say we get money from Iran. You can find people who've been trained there, but for the most part, that's very, very, it's very thin. And because really, if it were bigger than that, you'd see it. You know, the American army would have a press conference and they'd show you the Hezbollah trainers or the guys from Iran. They'd see it, but they don't, because even they have a very uncertain grasp of Iran's role.
Another really good question here is, does it really matter who wins the American election as it pertains to the cessation of the war?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If you would have asked that question, I think a year ago, the answer would have been absolutely, right? Iraq is completely imploded. It's in the throes of a civil war. Obama wants to get out in 16 months, and McCain, you know, will stay forever. But I think what's happened, I think they'd be different now, but I think that their positions have come together quite a bit, you know, even if they haven't said it. I personally can't imagine that the 16-month formula that Obama has laid out will stick. I mean, I think that's kind of a best-case scenario. And I think if he's confronted with the situation on the ground now, which is very, very different than it was a year ago or 2 years ago, I don't think he'll pull everybody out in 16 months. I'd be surprised. McCain, you can see McCain will stay forever. He'll stay for 100 years or whatever it takes. Yeah. He said that.
I have a follow-up Canadian question to that.
Yes.
As you may know, we have an election coming up before yours, October 14th.
Yes.
And our current prime minister has said that he will pull out in 2011 of Afghanistan. So I just wonder your thoughts of Canadians pulling out of Afghanistan.
Well, it does seem like in politics, 3 years is basically an eternity, right? Ask me in 3 years.
Yeah. Crazy. Okay, we're nearing the end of the questions here. Have you been desensitized by this overexposure to violence? And if so, how does it affect your reporting?
Well, have I been desensitized? No, I don't think so. I mean, you could read the book and see, I guess. But, I mean, you know, there's two ways to look at anything. You can look at something kind of intellectually, and you can look at it, or you can sort of experience it emotionally. And I think towards the end, before I left, to write the book, I was pretty numb, you know. I mean, I could go to a car bomb and sort of see the screaming mothers and the feet and the legs lying in the road and not be terribly moved by it. But, you know, that was car bomb number 385 or something. So, but I still, I like to think that I could still sympathize with people, you know. And I certainly, but, you know, it has its, takes its toll. If you see, like, too much of anything, you know, it's not the same, you know. I mean, I have friends, I think, you know, some people are just more resilient than other people. I mean, I have friends who, I have colleagues who, you know, are tormented by what they've seen. Yeah, in a way that I'm not. Yet. It's funny, I have a really good friend who left Iraq after about a year, and he'd been in Israel during the Intifada in 2002, and he was fine, you know, and great guy. And he never got nightmares when he was in Baghdad, but he started getting them after he left, you know. And his greatest fear, he said, I was dreaming that I was sleeping in our compound, the one with the 45 armed guards. And I'm waking up in the middle of the night, and I'm realizing that the bad guys have gotten inside. You know, that was his greatest fear. Yeah. Mm. Anyway.
That's it. We're out of time. Download the whole 32-minute Dexter Filkins Q&A session as a free MP3 from ecoshock.org. Click on Military in our Audio On Demand menu. Get Filkins' new book, Forever War, published by Knopf, at any bookseller. I'm Alex Smith, and I recorded this speech in Vancouver as presented by Capilano University on September 21st, 2008. Remember, Forever War is not an overtly anti-war book, but one reporter's eyes and ears on the ground. Much is missing from this speech: the millions of refugees, the wall built in Baghdad, the ethnic cleansing. Dexter reports for the New York Times, after all, and was often protected by American troops. Anyway, that isn't Filkin's goal. He finds people on all sides when he can, and reports like a living camera, putting you inside the flak jacket on the street. I think this is a worthwhile book, and it's a good read, but the judgment is left to you.
عربي أنا اخشيني الويل إذا أحببتني قلبي وحلمت وأشبعني رحيق شفتيك عربي أنا اخشيني